order. The first bill we're going to hear today is Senate Bill 641. And we have Mr. Dugan, Mr. Colby, Lieutenant Colby, and Ms. Keith. Mr. O'Leary, if you'd give us a summary of the bill.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 641A comes to you from Senator Ryan Deckert. The measure creates the misdemeanor crime of owning or possessing dogfighting paraphernalia with the intent that that paraphernalia be used in furtherance of a dogfight or to train a dog as a fighting dog. The current law makes it a Class C felony to promote or conduct or participate in a dogfight itself. This measure would create a new crime, a Class A misdemeanor, of owning or possessing the dogfighting paraphernalia with the intent to use it in furtherance of a dogfight. The measure defines dogfighting paraphernalia specifically, and it also specifically does not criminalize possession of any of the of any of the materials themselves, but the possession must be accompanied by evidence that the items were possessed with the intent that they be used in a dogfight or to train a fighting dog.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mike Dugan. I'm the district attorney in Deschutes County, Oregon. I'm representing today the Oregon District Attorneys Association. As we are in support of this bill, as you recall, this assembly has made illegal cockfighting and most recently the possession of the materials used to train fighting birds in the state of Oregon. It has long been against the law in Oregon to encourage, promote dogfighting. This bill does nothing more than to bring us into alignment with our cockfighting laws that prohibit the possession of the materials with the intent to use them for the purpose of training the birds, even though the birds would have been sent out of state. We do not want to encourage Oregonians to train their dogs here only to be sent out of state, so this would discourage that. We support the bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you for letting me testify this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Lieutenant, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lieutenant Randy Covey, Law Enforcement Division, Oregon Humane Society. Oregon Humane Society investigates dog fighting as part of our regular duties in enforcing other laws as well, animal welfare related. This bill, and I appreciate Senator Deckert bringing this bill forward, and the opportunity to testify in support of this bill today. This bill will help to make it easier for law enforcement officers to address dogfighting issues and, in fact, prevent the actual act of dogfighting by recognizing paraphernalia and things that they may find either in the course of our animal welfare investigations, or it also would assist what we call traditional law enforcement officers that may be dealing with drug crimes or weapons crimes by allowing them to recognize other types of paraphernalia related to dogfighting and address that at the same time. Oregon Humane Society supports this bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning in support of it.
Thank you. Marcia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marcia Keith, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. We are also in support of Senate Bill 641A. The amendment that was introduced into the bill on the Senate side actually came from us. We wanted to clarify that the veterinary medicine was a prescribed veterinary medicine in lines 15 and 16 on the page 1 of the bill. With that clarification, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association and its parent association, the American Veterinary Medical Association, are in favor of this bill. We have long held positions against both dogfighting and cockfighting, and see this bill as a way to ensure and to provide better protection to both animals and to society. We would urge your support of Senate Bill 641.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Just one. Maybe clarify, you kind of touched on a bit that since we have outlawed dogfighting here in Oregon, that people are maybe training dogs to be sent out of state, and that's why you want to outlaw the paraphernalia rather than focusing on an action. Is that what I'm understanding?
Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, we have already outlawed dogfighting in Oregon. And much like we had outlawed cockfighting in Oregon. What some of the unscrupulous folks did who owned those fighting birds, they just claimed they were training them here and not cockfighting. We want to prevent that here as well. In addition to that, I've got my judicial thing going here. In addition to that, the evidence that we're seeking to prohibit, or the items that we're seeking to prohibit, will be prohibited with the intent to train or use in dog fighting. And people who possess this may also have some other issues as well. Not to mention the least of which would be child abuse, drug addictions, and other things. But when the animal control officers go into these homes or farms or ranches and find this stuff, discourage the possession of it and certainly be able to investigate whether or not it's being used for unlawful purposes.
One more question. So just merely owning this stuff would allow punishment up to 1 year and a $6,250 fine or both. But the action, if you see them training dogs without this paraphernalia, would you be able to go after them?
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, the mere possession of these items alone without more is not illegal. The possession of this with the intent to use them for training or using them in dog fighting, just to train dogs to fight, they actually have to fight them, would be illegal. So the mere possession alone is not what we're going after.
I guess what I'm getting at is if they would say, if I were a dog fighting or wanting to train with these dogs, I'd look at the list and go, well, I'll find something different to train with and get around it. And would the actual act of training them be against the law without this paraphernalia? I guess maybe it's not possible, but...
I'd be happy to take that. Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, current law actually addresses that issue. It does address questions of participating in activity related to dogfighting. So this bill simply deals with the paraphernalia itself, as Mr. Dugan has appropriately pointed out. Other issues related to dog fighting, participation, and things of that nature are already addressed in current law. It's a good question. I appreciate the opportunity to clarify that.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Duggan or Mr. Lieutenant Covey, Mr. Duggan, are there circumstances where you might come upon some of the items that are listed in this bill and obtain statements from suspects with respect to what they're using those items for, and under current law not be able to prosecute them under a current statute?
There are, Mr. Chair, Mr. O'Leary. Again, the opportunity to clarify is appreciated. There are circumstances under current law where we could find this paraphernalia and not be able to address it, even though we know that the intent, as you stated, maybe even based on their own admission, is to use them for dogfighting. So this law will allow us to use not only their own statements, but maybe other evidence that we may find that helps to prove intent to use it for dogfighting, and will make it enable us to be able to prosecute for that crime.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else who testify on that bill? No. Public hearing on Senate Bill 641. Open a work session on Senate Bill 641.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 641 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative
McCutcheon?
Aye.
Representative
Wilson?
Aye.
Representative
Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative Foster will carry the bill. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 128. And we have Secretary Dugan and Dan Mallon.
Would you like a summary?
And Mr. O'Leary, a summary, please.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 128 comes to you from the Oregon State Police. This is a bill that would amend the grand jury statute. It would permit custodian of records from the state police of sex offender records to forward sex offender registration records to a grand jury who is investigating a charge of failure to report as a sex offender and receive those records or a certified copy of those records into evidence if they are accompanied by an affidavit by the custodian of the records swearing that those records are a complete copy of the record. This would be an important change from current law because currently there is no such exception to the personal appearance requirement for the custodian of these records, and where the current practice is that the custodian is required to actually appear in person only to deliver the records to the grand jury with the statement that they are true and complete and accurate copies of the records.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to Senate Bill 128 and the hearing that you're having today. Council clearly addressed the bill and explained the points of the bill. As the former manager of the Sex Offender Registration Unit, on average, we would be subpoenaed 15 to 20 times a month to attend grand jury hearings in some counties in the state. And that would take a considerable amount of time when you consider the distance from Salem to the county courthouses. And the time that's being spent is being spent by administrative specialist ones in the sex offender registration unit whose duties are to process those registrations in a timely manner. So their time outside of the sex offender registration unit reduces the timely entry of registrations into the state's registry. This would save us some time to focus on these other duties. And the reason that we have to respond to the subpoenas, we always respond to subpoenas for trials for persons being charged with failure to register. But routinely a 2 or 3 minute appearance at a grand jury hearing with 2 hours of travel time is just not fiscally very, very smart.
Could I ask you, did they ever ask you any questions when you present the grand jury? Here's the stuff.
I've testified probably at 15 of these. There are some times when we walk the grand jury through statutes, the forms, the process, and explain clearly why the person is not in compliance with the state's sex offender registration statutes. But I would mention that I think the district attorney would be able to do that just as easily. And the reasons that we continue to be requested at some of these counties is because they say there's not a provision in statute not to.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Mr. Dugan.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. I am, again, Mike Dugan. I'm the district attorney from Deschutes County. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of Senate Bill 128. The addition of the paragraph, subsection 8, as reported by our testimony reported earlier, makes sense. It makes sense from the standpoint of dollars and cents that state police would otherwise have to spend in attending the grand jury proceedings. I do want to point out that this section is consistent with section 4 that allows an affidavit of a peace officer when charging somebody with driving while suspended, and it's also consistent with subsection 9, which allows the affidavit of a police officer regarding certain parts of a driving under the influence of intoxicant charge. I do want to point out that I think there may be a typo in section 1, where it says, except as provided in subsections 2 through 8, the investigation, etc., and goes on and on. I think that should read 2 through 10. Because subsection 10 does allow the testimony by affidavit, and I think the intent is to allow all of those different types of evidence to be introduced at the grand jury without the exclusion of the new subsection 10. And otherwise, the Oregon District Attorney support this position. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, do you want to take a look at that, too, just for your legal advice on that letter? Would you take a look at that question?
It's Mr. O'Leary's question.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at that right now.
But 2 months, I mean.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, I actually I have to respectfully disagree, I think, with Mr. Duggan. I think that is accurate in so far as the original version provided that except in subsection 2, which is one of the provisions allowing for the report or copy of a report by a chemist, an examiner, etc., and then what was formerly subsection 7, and it is inserting subsection 8, which is the new section that's created by this bill. So it appears to me what paragraph 1 is doing, section 1, paragraph 1, is stating the exceptions to the rule that a person must appear in person, a witness must appear in person, unless I've got it backwards.
Mr. Chair and Mr. O'Leary, I think you're missing the connection. It took me a little bit to read it myself, but generally speaking, only evidence that is admissible at a trial is admissible in a grand jury unless there are some exceptions carved out, and this is one of the statutes that has carved out those exceptions. Subsection 1 specifically provides, except that provided in the rest of these sections, only the evidence that would be admitted at a trial can be admitted at a grand jury. But subsection 10 provides one of those exceptions, which is exactly almost in the same written language as subsection, the new subsection 8, or which says a grand jury, subsection 8 says the grand jury that is investigating a charge of failure to report a sex offender.
So your point is subsection 10 should also be listed in
subsection 10
sub
should
1.
Also be listed there because a grand jury that is investigating a charge of. So that's my only point.
I follow you now. Yeah. I could we could carry this over and I could get this down to Virginia Vanderbilt to correct. I do see your point, Mr. Duggan. I think it's an accurate one.
Okay, thank you.
I might comment. I agree with the point. It's a point that is a problem in the existing law rather than one that's created by this bill.
Right.
And so another possibility would be for us to move this bill as it is and then note this it for the next session's general cleanup of all the little bugs that have been found in the ORS.
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, I would hope that we didn't do that because that would still leave that subsection 10 for the next 2 years meaningless. It wouldn't have any effect, I suppose, because it wouldn't allow us, because of subsection 1, to introduce that affidavit on those circumstances.
Thank you. Any further questions, panel? Thank you. I close the public hearing and open a work hearing. Representative Chris, what I would like to do is make a conceptual amendment.
Let's do a conceptual amendment.
We'll and we'll move it forward. We'll move it forward to the full committee, and then by tomorrow we'll have that ready to go.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Okay. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules and permit a conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 128 in committee.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Then I move that we conceptually amend Senate Bill 128 to strike. And on page 1, line 5, the inserted reference paren 8, close paren, and replace it with paren 10, close paren. But this says 2-7, and then maybe then we get 2-8, wouldn't we? Except so it's 2-10. I mean, there is maybe the question of whether 9 is an exception, but I think that even if it were overly broad, I think it would still work. So I think the conceptual amendment I just stated, replacing the reference to 8 on page 1, line 5, with a reference to 10 as the inserted cross-reference, would do the job. So that's my motion.
Okay, thank you. Representative McPherson has moved. We move this forward with the conceptual amendment to full committee. Or is there any discussion?
Okay. Let me just understand. Are you adding section 10 to 8? Or are you taking
out 8? Right now the language is 2-7. That's the existing law.
Mm-hmm.
It should have been 2-9. Because what it was the prior 9 and now becomes 10 is an exception, as Mr. Dugan pointed out, to and he's concerned that we haven't effectively authorized this receipt of evidence that is described in the old 9, now 10.
Okay.
So we're just extending to the end of the section the cross reference.
Right. Okay. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Olson? He's in the hall. I sure get him. Yeah. Would you, Bill? Apparently, it was challenged in authority to receive the evidence that's in the old nine.
Representative
Olson,
Attorney
General.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye.
128 moved to full committee.
Actually, I think, Mr. Chair, I amended it, but I didn't actually move it forward, so we probably had a separate motion. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 128 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Representative McPherson can carry that one. Okay, so we're reading the numbers, right? I'm going to do that. We have several people here on a couple of bills. I'm going to run out Senate Bill, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 153.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 153A comes to you from the Joint Interim Committee on Transportation, Trade, and Economic Development. Requires each city operating a photo red light camera or photo radar system to present biannual reports to Legislative Assembly. Prohibits use of photo radar unless sign indicating camera is operation is placed on the street where the device is being located. Allows registered vehicle owners to respond with certificate of innocence.
Thank you. Senator.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Barker, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and thank you for your consideration of Senate Bill 153A. I know you have a very busy schedule this time of session, so I will be brief but be available for questions for anything that you would like to ask about this. Senate Bill 153 was the result of an extensive discussion in Senate Transportation earlier this session, and it was designed originally and where I think we are now is to bring uniformity, I think would be the best word to use, to cities who have been authorized to use photo red light and photo radar. And I think many of you are probably aware that one jurisdiction, the city of Beaverton, had a difference of opinion, shall we say, on what the law actually said the jurisdiction was allowed to do. And what 1753A seeks to do is to make it very, very clear what the legislature meant and what jurisdictions can and cannot do in operating photo radar and photo red light. I do appreciate very much the city of Beaverton understanding the need to conform to what the city of Portland and Newburgh and other cities were doing on this. I know they've already made changes as a result of this legislation, and this will make sure that any jurisdiction who has been authorized actually conforms to the law. Specifically, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there was testimony that was presented in committee that while the legislation said, for example, with the use of a photo radar van, that that people must be notified of that within 100 to 400 feet of the intersection where that van may be used, in some cases, the city of Beaverton had been accused of actually having that notification after you had gone through the intersection, but it was within 1 to 400 feet. And while we thought that was common sense, this bill specifically says it must also be before you enter the intersection. There was also testimony, and I think you've read about this, there was a lot of coverage in the Oregonian, of demanding that people actually appear in court when they were cited as opposed to responding by mail. This makes it clear that you can respond by mail. Thirdly, it also makes it very clear that it is not a requirement after you have submitted a certificate of innocence with the driver's license that shows you were not the that you were not the driver at the time, that the law does not require that you identify and provide the driver's license number and other material of the person who was driving. That would be the responsibility of the jurisdiction to determine that. And in cases, many cases, the city of Beaverton at one time was actually demanding before they would allow you off the hook, so to speak, even though you clearly were not driving, require that you identify clearly who the driver was before they would allow that to happen. All the other jurisdictions who have been authorized made it clear that they did never interpret the law that way. That's not how they operated. What Senate Bill 153 does is make sure that all jurisdictions clearly understand and follow the law and do not exceed the limitations of the law. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. I might add, just having recently driven through a radar zone there, not only did they have a sign before, but Beaverton now has a sign afterwards letting people know in case they didn't notice all the way through that they had just driven through one, so to keep them alert to the fact. So, thank you. Mr. Costales?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Good morning. My testimony in relationship to Senate Bill 153A is just three small parts. First, photo radar and photo red light work. They make a difference. It's been proven not only in Oregon, but across the U.S., if not across the world. Second, ODOT is mentioned in this part of the law, but wanted to let you know that ODOT has no authority in relationship to the cities and jurisdictions that are running these devices. Third, our piece to this is that we are being requested to create an executive summary every March of a legislative session on how the programs are working and what the impact is. This bill creates and brings back a report and executive summary on the photo radar piece that in the 97-99 sessions was eliminated because they had been running for a while, the reports had been turned in, and the legislature in 97-99 removed the reporting piece, and this is in 2005 would be reinstalling a photo radar report. The red light running, the intersection cameras, has had a report along with it all along since it was put in place and authorized by the legislature. And so it would be a new piece of work for the department and a new piece of work for the cities that are operating photo radar that they haven't had to do since 1999. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than happy to try and answer any questions the subcommittee may have.
Any questions from the subcommittee?
Yes, Representative
Thatcher.
It's my understanding that this makes jurisdictions that are authorized to implement the photo radar, photo red light, stick with the intent of the law. Does it allow for more jurisdictions to decide they want to join in on this? Or is this spread it, so to speak?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thatcher, this bill does not extend the list of the cities authorized to use photo radar, nor does it extend the authorization for the red light running intersection. Those are already prescribed in what the qualifications are, or the cities are listed specifically in current statute.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I believe...
Just following up on that question, although it's actually a question I wanted to put to Senator Metzger, but we didn't give him a chance to respond to any questions.
I'm sorry.
So if I could. First, Senator Metzger, I want to applaud your work on getting the photo radar statute in better shape so that there's a clear understanding among Oregon municipalities who use it about how it's to operate. I wanted to ask you what the variation on the question that was just put to Mr. Costales, what's your view on adding to the rather narrow list of seven cities that are now the only ones authorized in Oregon to conduct photo radar?
Well, this has been brought up a couple of times, both last session when I chaired transportation and again this session. I know there are a number of other jurisdictions who would like to be included. I have never been an advocate of increasing, but I have not been an opponent of others who would like to be involved in that. The issue that has, when it was brought before the 2003 legislative session and the discussions in the Transportation Committee this year in 2005, I think it would just be fair to characterize Representative McPherson that there were constitutional issues with the ability to get sufficient votes to do that. And as I said to the chairman of the full committee and others earlier in the session, I would not be a roadblock on any decision by the House of Representatives if they should so decide to add cities to it. But I wouldn't be counted on to be an advocate. I mean, that would be if this body decided that that was appropriate, then I would certainly be supportive of that. If the body decided that they would still like to just stand down and keep the existing number of cities, then I would be fine with that as well. And I think that would be your decision as a committee and as a body.
To go to work session.
Just to follow up, not really a question, but a comment. I think that we're in a process of sort of expanding the understanding about how this technology can work, and I think that the effort that's been put in on Senate Bill 887 or Senate 153 has advanced that process. But I think that part of that process too is then expanding the reach of it so that more Oregonians have an opportunity to see how it can work and become comfortable with it, because I think the tendency is for there to be a great discomfort with it, as there is oftentimes to new technologies that they become, after a while, much more comfortable to people after they understand how they work. So it's I think would be consistent with the work that you've done this session to expand that scope a little bit.
Well, one comment I would have, Representative McPherson, is, I mean, I think that's a very valid point, and hopefully the contents of 153, when people have seen violations of the law, I think has eroded that confidence. And with the implementation of 153 and consistency, then maybe that public support would in fact be generated in other areas, and the body may have a different reaction to it. Certainly consistency, I think, is one of the key issues that has given people pause in the past about expanding a program of which others would take their own liberties to interpret, and hopefully this will provide that consistency and maybe strengthen that argument.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further? Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 153, and that's only scheduled for hearing this morning, so thank you. We're not going to be able to have a hearing on Senate Bill 240 until 10 o'clock. And then we'll open it. Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 61A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 61A comes to you from at the request of Governor Kulongowski for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. John Minnis is here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may remember at our last meeting on this bill, when we were in work session, we had discussion about whether this was expanding the scope of the bill. And after the meeting, I looked at it and then talked with Representative Thatcher, Representative McPherson, and John Minnis, and actually it's not. Let me, the language that we were having problems with is at the end of page 2 and at the top of page 3. And if you look at the first page of the bill on lines 12 through 18, what Legislative Council's office did was, for the purposes of clarity, reposition the language in the statute. So that language is already there. So when we had examples concerning people that were watching TV cameras and whether they would be within the scope of the bill, well, they may very well be under the scope of the law as it is now. So the bill itself is not making a policy change in that area. And I would suggest that maybe Mr. Minnis could come up and describe to the committee exactly what the bill is doing. I think what it's doing is actually making the process and procedure simpler.
Great. Thank you. Director Minnis?
Mr. Chairman, members of the House Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee on Criminal Law, gentlemen to my right, I'm John Minnis. I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Brian Henson is the supervisor of the private security section of the agency, and he has much greater background and understanding of the operations of this section. But I do agree with Mr. Taylor, and I have to apologize to the committee for not explaining that the bill didn't provide any substantial expansion. In fact, I think in our view, and the objective of the bill was to really provide a greater degree of flexibility and an ability to work with the industry to provide greater service to those folks through the accreditation of training programs that already exist within the industry. And then also to let the Private Security Policy Committee work with the industry to develop some additional guidelines and policies or administrative rule that might serve their needs. I do agree, though, with, I think, some of the comments Representative McPherson and I have had about some of the broadness of the existing statute. And I guess I would offer to you that during the interim or at some other point in the future, we'd be glad to work with you to try to narrow that to the extent that it's practicable, although it does seem to be somewhat of a very complex discussion to have at this late stage of the session. And if you have any specific questions, I think Mr. Hansen's certainly better qualified to answer those questions.
Questions?
Really not. It was just a comment, Mr. Chair, and I should apologize to the committee in that I'm the only one here who's, I think, through a formal legal training, and I should really have been able to read this thing on the run and arrive at what was pointed out to me that things were just reshuffled here. So I think we're in good shape here in terms of reflecting what is existing law. I think there is the issue about whether it's overly broad, and I would certainly urge Representative Thatcher, if you're of a mind to want to try to focus in on that issue, I would certainly aid whatever effort you wanted to undertake. But I think that this is a good approach, the way we have it here, in terms of taking existing law and making it a little clearer.
I possibly have a conflict on this one because I have hired my husband's company to check my internet, whatever, video surveillance, though it's mostly been rewinding it, not an actual live observation, so I'm not sure if it qualifies or not, but all right.
Okay. So we are in a work session.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 61A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Hearing none. Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
No, he's excused. He's had to see the speaker.
Representative
Thatcher?
Aye. Chair
Barker? Aye. Moves to the full committee with a due pass, and Representative McPherson carrying that. Next, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 62.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 62 comes to you from Governor Ted Kulongoski on behalf of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And you should have the dash five amendments in front of you. And chair, members of the committee, they do two things. They incorporate what was discussed the other day as it relates to the dash one amendments, which include and do certain things as it relates to firefighters. And they also include what's conflict amendments. You may remember we had discussions that one of the other bills that we had up in this bill amend, especially the amendments of this bill, amend the same section of the ORS, and it requires a conflict amendment. It says if Senate Bill 63 becomes law, Section 1 of this 2005 section is repealed, and ORS 181-640 is amended by section of this law is amended to read as follows. That's a conflict amendment, Mr. Chairman of the Committee. with the Dash Amendment, one amendments to allow the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and they're incorporating the Dash 5 to deny, suspend, or revoke the certification of a fire service professional. May suspend or revoke a fire service professional's license under conviction for crime, allows the department to request the state police criminal records, and sets forth a process and procedure for doing that. And Mr. Mendes is here if you have any.
Does anybody have any questions for the director?
Just one question.
You have a representative?
Well, I'm not sure.
Somebody
you can go up here just in case, but yeah. I noticed on page 7, section 4, subsection 3, the FBI is returning the fingerprint cards. Where are they returning them? Is it to just to the agencies? I believe
it would be through the Oregon State Police.
Yeah. Okay.
Because the agency makes a record request through the Oregon State Police.
Okay.
I think that's right. Do they keep a record of that? I mean, it seems there's been, years ago my wife had an insurance license and she had to be fingerprinted, and I assume they kept those in their non-criminal records file. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know. I believe that there's been quite a bit of scrutiny of the retention of those records by the state police, and I think criticism, as you may well know, regarding the retention by the federal agencies, too. So I think my guess would be that the Oregon State Police would be very circumspect in addressing the law and not violating that. I think they would find themselves in deep kimchi if they were retaining records they should have not. So.
Okay.
Real quick question. Yeah. Before suspending, without speed reading here, because I'm not really good at that, they are allowed a hearing, I take it.
That's correct.
I thought, there it is. It's on the other amendment. So I knew I saw that somewhere. All right, so there's written notice and there's a hearing, so there's a process in place so that they can defend themselves.
That's correct. In the event that there are errors in the record, they would have an opportunity to correct the record.
And if that is still, they still don't agree with your finding, are they able to, sorry, follow up.
No, please.
Are they still able to... Is there some sort of process that's still available to them?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I don't know, other than potentially filing a civil action against the agency that retains the records, or potentially against the state for our interpretation of the records. If we're relying on the records, for instance, of NCIC, the federal government, and we're making a determination, we agree with the FBI in terms of the appeal or the records and say that the records are clear. If they wanted to, I guess, contest that, I believe they'd have to file a civil suit at some point. I don't know that there's another process.
Is this an administrative law process here? So there'd be an administrative law judge involved, and then they would take it to the Court of Appeals if there was a disagreement, or?
I honestly, Mr. Chairman, I do not know that this would an appeal of this nature. Here, look at this. And forgive me, because I believe that the private security section has, again, greater detail in this and greater experience, but he does say it does provide for an administrative procedures hearing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, yes, it is an administrative hearings process. The individuals would be able to request a hearing through the department. The department would go forward, process that hearing request. It would go before an administrative law judge. A proposed order would be issued on the law judge's findings. The department would issue the final order. If the individual was still contesting the final order, then they would go forward for judicial review. And that judicial review from there, they would always have the right to go forward, but it typically ends in judicial review.
And is the agency's final order always based on the findings from the administrative law judge, or can they go another direction?
The agency can, Representative Thatcher, the agency can go another direction, but in reality, the agency is going to take the findings of the ALJ into consideration when making all its considerations.
And could you state your name for the record?
I'm Brian Henson. I work for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thatcher, I think to the extent that the agency did not follow the ALJ's recommendation and became an issue of law, I think that's where we end up with some potential civil litigation.
It seems like it, yeah.
Okay. Anything further? Could I have a moment? Okay. We're in work session.
No, okay. Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 6. Oh, no, the Dash 5 amendments? Senate Bill 62?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Thank you. Move it. Representative Thatcher moves the dash fives. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 62 as amended to the full committee as with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Take the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson excused. Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Yeah, I'll carry that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Manners. Okay, next. 2568 bill,
the
speed law.
That's not a Przanski's bill.
I just called and there's no answer.
Let me go down to his office.
I sent Dale over there.
Okay.
So we could do 243 if you want to jump around.
Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 243. Mr. O'Leary.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 243 comes to you from the Parole Board. This is a bill that would modify the conditions of post-prison supervision and of parole for individuals convicted of sex crimes. The current statute imposes on both post-prison supervision and parole a condition that prohibits frequenting places where persons under 18 are likely to congregate without the prior written approval of the board. The term frequenting within the text of that prohibition has been interpreted by the Court of Appeals as meaning often, which is translated to the belief that a person who has been convicted of a sex crime cannot be found in violation of their supervision unless they have gone to a place where a person under 18 regularly congregates over and over again or often. So the concern or the problem this bill addresses is to make that a little more tight. And the way this bill does it is by amending those statutes prescribing the conditions of post-prison supervision to impose a wholesale prohibition on persons convicted of sex crimes from being present at all on or near the grounds of a school, child care center, playground, or other place intended primarily for use by children without prior written approval. Then the measure goes on and addresses a second tier and makes a further condition of supervision to prohibit such persons from being present more than one time at a place where persons under 18 regularly congregate without prior written approval.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Darcy Baker. I'm a member of the Oregon Parole Board, and with me is former Senator Len Hannon, who's also a member of the board. Mr. O'Leary has correctly stated the problem, why the board is brought this issue to the legislature, and the board is here in support of this amendment and would recommend that it proceed with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any questions?
Ms. Chair, I'm just here for the record, and my name is Len Hannon, a member of the board, and we again support the bill and urge its passage.
Okay, I'll just add in there, we've had testimony in other bills
yes.
regarding the fact that these sexual predators will groom their young victims, and by frequenting places such as the swimming pool and so on. We just had a bill go through. So we appreciate you coming in and testifying.
I don't know, maybe you can't answer them. I'm just curious, without prior written approval kind of comes in here into this bill a lot, or at least in the description here. I'm just wondering, where do they get the written approval from, and how many people actually apply for written approval to go to Enchanted Forest?
Well, they get the written approval from their parole officer, and that's typically in conjunction with staffing that with a therapist, maybe with a sex offender unit. And the conditions of supervision are reviewed thoroughly when an offender is placed on parole or probation and going through. This is exactly what this means. Many counties have a special package just talking about contact with minors and what that is. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, does this apply to people who've been designated as predatory sex offenders, or is it just anybody who's committed a sex offense?
Anyone who's... Chair Barker, members of the committee. This applies to everyone who is on parole, post-prison supervision, or probation for a sex crime listed in ORS 181-594.
And follow up, if I could. And what's the nature of those offenses, the ones in the reference sheet, cross-reference you just mentioned?
They are all the crimes that you would think of as your typical sex offenses, rape, sodomy, sex abuse, contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, in some circumstances kidnapping in the first degree or burglary. So it's not just predatory sex offenders, but those who have been convicted of a qualifying sex crime.
Okay, and another, if I might, Mr. Chair, and is there discretion in the parole officer or probation officer to apply that restriction, or is this just a blanket restriction on anyone who's been ever been convicted of one of those offenses?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, there is some discretion on the part of the parole officer. Again, as an offender moves through supervision and as we find out more about their sexual assault cycle and in consultation with the therapist, they may be granted permission to have supervised contact with specific minors, specifically if they have children. And those children have been ruled as not a victim of their sex offense, or maybe if they have been ruled or found to be a victim after therapy and after the victim has been in therapy. So there is some latitude to, I guess, ease up on the restriction under the appropriate circumstances.
Where I'm headed with that, those questions, is that when we focus on take all the range of sex offenses, not just limiting it to people who are sexual predators, there are probably some people for whom these restrictions would be probably unnecessary. And what I'm hearing is that there is the sufficient discretion for the parole or probation officer to decide whether or not this restriction should apply.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I guess a little background. First of all, I'm a former parole and probation officer and spent the last 10 years supervising sex offenders. And so when an offender came to us, one of the first things we try to do would be to get a sexual history polygraph examination and find out the breadth of their sex offending. And then, you know, through treatment, as they demonstrate their ability to adhere to the conditions of supervision, that they aren't a danger, then would ease up on those restrictions. So I guess in the beginning we take a very narrow approach, and then as appropriate we grant permission for contact.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll move Senate Bill 243 to a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 243 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Hearing none. Roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson, excuse. Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Joe Barker?
Aye. Yeah, Representative McPherson, carry that.
We can do this one.
Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1045. And
Nancy Miller and Mike Mason.
Mike Mason and Nancy Miller.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1045 comes to you from the Committee on Rules. This is the bill that would extend the sunset on the current law that allows an agreement between the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs and the Jefferson and Crook County Courts to enter into agreements regarding adjudication and disposition of youths in the juvenile delinquency system. The law passed in 2003 allows the juvenile courts of those two counties to waive jurisdiction over youths and transfer the case to the tribal court of Warm Springs for adjudication and disposition. They may only apply to youths who are enrolled members of a federally recognized tribe or who reside on the Warm Springs Reservation. The sunset will repeal the law on January 2nd, 2006. This measure would extend the sunset, allowing this pilot program to continue through January 2, 2010.
Thank you, Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the Criminal Subcommittee of House Judiciary. For the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. I'm mostly here to answer questions. They consider this bill very important, and obviously the legislature agreed with that because last time it passed both houses unanimously, and this time it passed the Senate unanimously. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I would emphasize that it's very important partly because we do not have any transfers yet. This is something that's up to the district attorney to recommend the transfer, but we do consider this very important. We think that by the end of the year we'll have some transfers and we'll have the opportunity to keep these families together. We have one situation in particular where a child is in Klamath Falls and it's been almost a year since he's been in the Warm Springs area, and that's quite a hardship. We wouldn't have that, and I would just emphasize that as anybody who's grown up in a small town can attest, that it's your own family and elders that have a lot more influence on shaping you up than it is somebody from the next county or the next jurisdiction over. And that's when you see these kids and the respect that they have for the elders, you really see it, how this can work, you know, to have these transfers to the Warm Springs Juvenile Court. So happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Well, I would just like an how many in the, you said you don't have any transfers right now?
We don't have any now. The agreement has been in effect for about a year, but we haven't had any cases transferred under it yet. Now, this is only for the nonviolent situations, so it's not going to be a lot of cases anyway. But
have you ever had any?
Well, we haven't had any transfers.
Okay, so it's just started a year ago. Okay, gotcha.
Right. We just got the agreement in place a year ago, and that was, as you see with the testimony, that's fairly brief agreement. And so there's some issues still to work out between the district attorney and the court administrator at Warm Springs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations in the Judicial Department, and I'm here today on behalf of Judge George Nielsen, who's the presiding judge, who could not be here and sends his regrets. And I just want to echo what Mr. Mason said. This is an important pilot for the tribe and the court. I spoke to Judge Nielsen, and he said that, as expected, this has taken some time to work itself out. He said that there are about 9 cases, I think, under consideration for transfer at this point in time, and he has every confidence that this will move forward and show itself to be the success that we predicted it would be, but it does take some time.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just a little further background here. Just tell me a little bit about tribal courts and how they compare to the way a sort of regular circuit court or wherever juvenile offenders would ordinarily be handled.
Well, a lot of the rules are the same. To some extent, there's less formality in the tribal courts. So far, most of the tribal courts, I should say tribal juvenile courts in Oregon, still maintain the confidentiality standards that the state courts used to maintain. So there certainly is the ability to have different procedures. And in some ways, I would say they're more conservative. But in other ways, I don't think there's much of a difference in operation from what I've seen. I mean, the rules are pretty much the same. So if you walked into the court, you might see a little less formality on the part of the judge, but you might not. I mean, Judge Sohappy is very stern, and it's a very serious environment. I think there's more flexibility in terms of both sentencing, if you're on the criminal side, but on the juvenile side, I wouldn't call it sentencing, but in, I guess, disposition of the case. There'd be more flexibility in the kinds of actions that would be ordered for the child and bringing in the family and ordering them to do various things.
And Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the simple answer too is that, of course, the tribal courts are subject to the federal law. They are not subject to the state law. They are governed by their tribal charter.
That's correct, Representative. The tribal constitution governs.
That's
first
it.
The treaty, then the tribal constitution. And by the way, while I'm here, mention it's the 150th anniversary of the Treaty of Mill, Oregon, mm-hmm. as you're, I think, aware from voting for the resolution the other day. So you go to the treaty, you go then to the constitution, and there are some federal requirements, but primarily it's actually tribal law. So you have extensive tribal juvenile code that is used,
and
that the judge uses.
And Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the tribal judges are invited to the training that we do for our state juvenile court judges, and the Warm Springs tribe has been probably the best represented tribe that comes to our summer conference for juvenile court judges. So we're doing a lot more interaction between the state courts and the tribal courts. I've done training on child welfare law, the federal law, and because the tribes are starting to draw federal money, they're subject to the provisions of those federal laws. I've done training for almost all of the tribes, the tribal courts on those laws. They're using our model court orders, so there's a lot more interface than there used to be between the state courts and the tribal courts.
Okay. Just one follow-up. And the judge in a tribal court, what kind of, besides that sort of practical training, what kind of legal training or other might that person have?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, it depends on the court. Usually now tribal judges are attorneys, usually with fairly extensive experience in Indian law. In the case of juvenile courts, however, it's often the case that the tribal judge is not an attorney, may have been a paralegal, has been active in the court system prior to being a judge, but is very steeped in the culture and traditions, especially regarding families, on the reservation. And that's the case with at least one of our juvenile judges. So there's a deep understanding. I mean, there's legal training, but it's the tribal laws and the ancient laws, and to some extent natural law, we would say. They wouldn't say natural law. They would say the law directly given to them by the Creator from listening to the land and other activities. But it's, in the case of Warm Springs, it's either going to be an attorney with fairly extensive experience in Indian law or a respected elder who is the juvenile court judge.
Hmm.
Okay. That's all I had.
Well, I just kind of wanted an example of, and maybe that's hard to come up with since there haven't been any transfers, but have you adjudicated youth in the system before? What kind of sentences would they be given in comparison? I mean, what that you anticipate would be?
Well, Representative Thatcher, the tribal juvenile court's been operating for at least 30 years. I'm not sure exactly when it was started, but at least 30 years. And the Warm Springs Tribal Court has been operating for over 60 years. So they have certainly, just to clarify, this is only dealing with the cases that are outside reservation, that thus thrust a child under jurisdiction of the 22nd district. The cases where a child, say, commits vandalism or, you know, some kind of shenanigans that get them into trouble on the reservation go straight to tribal juvenile court. And so they have handled quite a few cases. And as far as the sentencing, I would have to go back and find out exactly how they have dealt with those. But I can assure you they are at least as serious and severe on their, well, sentencing, as it were. That's not the right term exactly, but on their disposition of the cases as the 22nd district will be.
Any further? Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1045. Move to a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1045 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Hearing none.
Representative
Olson.
Aye.
Representative
Thatcher.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Representative Olson. Carry that one. We're still just a couple of minutes short of 10 o'clock, so I'm going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 568A. Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 568A comes to you from Senator Forzansky at the request of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Allows the court to suspend a person's driving privileges for up to 30 days if a person exceeds the speed limit by more than 30 miles an hour. If a person is driving 100 miles per hour or greater, requires the court to impose a fine of $1,000 and suspend the person's license not less than 30 days, not more than 90 days.
Okay. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First, just a clarification. Regarding the 30-mile-an-hour, it also requires that the person has been convicted of a speeding violation within the last 12 months. So, in other words, an individual would not be losing their license for the first offense. If it's over 30 miles an hour, they would have to have had a prior speeding offense that had resulted in a conviction within the last 12 months. Now, it's true that that first conviction does not need to be based on exceeding the speed by 30 the first time. It's only the second time is where it would be the 30-mile-an-hour requirement. The reason for this bill is quite simple, is that as a prosecutor, I can tell you that there have been a number of cases where individuals just don't get the message. They continue to speed because it, to them, it's just basically a fine to pay, and they don't feel that they're a threat to themselves or others. We know from history and from the stats that's not the outcome in many cases where there are wrecks. It's directly attributed to the speed that someone may be driving. What this bill will, in fact, do is allow the court on the first component, if someone is speeding 30 miles an hour when they're convicted of a second offense within a 12-month period, to have the option to use a suspension of the driver's license for up to 30 days. And this would be more of a wake-up call, hopefully, for those individuals that are driving, that the court, that the communities of this state and the citizens of this state will take this much more serious, and we want to make certain that individuals are operating vehicles at a safe and reasonable speed. Clearly, we have seen cases, and I will call your attention to the case that happened most recently in March, end of March. This was a situation where a teenager up in the I-205 area close to Oregon City was clocked by a state trooper doing 142 miles an hour. And I guess what I would say is that when working with the state police, we came to a conclusion that if anyone is driving over 100 miles or over triple digit, that they should in fact have a mandatory suspension because the risk is so great. A lot of people may think, well, it's just maybe me and my vehicle. In this case, the young man, I saw him being interviewed, and he took a position. He's 19 years of age, that he was out there. There's no real risk to anyone else, but the reality, there's so many things that can happen when you're driving at that speed that you have no control over, and if anything went wrong, in the sense of someone stepping out where you didn't think anyone was at, they would be dead, and the tragedy would continue. So what we're trying to do is get a message across in this state that if you're driving at excess speeds, especially over 100 miles an hour, that you will lose your license for a period of time. The suspension period for that would be a minimum of 30 days, a maximum of 90 days. This is a bill that, as counsel has said, was brought to my attention through the State Police Officers Association. And in working with them, we came up with the bill that's before you. And we have made one modification change, and that was to add the requirement for a second offense before you would lose or have the discretion at the court level to suspend someone's license for 30 days.
Questions? Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Are they doing this in any other states that you found?
Representative Thatcher, I have not done an exhaustive look at what other states are doing. I guess maybe tend the question back to Representative Olson or Representative Barker. Maybe they may have some information from their past work and the law enforcement area.
I don't know about any other states, but 35 years ago when I was a state trooper in Washington County, anybody who exceeded 100 miles an hour spent a weekend in jail to get their attention. They felt that was that serious even back then.
Yeah, I think Mr. Chair and Senator Przanski, California was actually looking at doing something similar to this, and I have not heard any further about what they've done with that. I do have a question, though, Mr. Chair, or maybe a point, I guess, Senator. I see that this is no fiscal impact, and I'm just thinking how many citations used to come in for triple digits all the time out of the Albany office. You know, that's only 65,000 cars a day, and I know down Eugene you're up close to about 90,000 on I-5. I would surely think that with the impact of those that like to exceed that speed limit, there should maybe be a little bit of a fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, we did not hear anything back from ODOT that gave us any indication that the numbers that they would be dealing with would be noticeable in the sense of from the regular processing. As you well aware, the way the process works is the court is required to submit certain paperwork to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and they do that already when there's a suspension entered by the court. And all I can tell you is that in my discussions and as the bill went through on the Senate side, there was no concern that was raised by ODOT of having any significance as to the additional processing of those suspensions.
Mr. Chair, I think there's a lot of folks out on the freeway that enforce that speed law, so would probably greatly support this.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Move to a work session.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate Bill 568 be moved to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Here you go. Okay, call the roll, please.
Representative
Olson?
Aye.
Representative Bolton?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And my good friend, the tail light chaser, Olson,
can
do that one.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I need pursuit, Olson. Open hearing on Senate Bill 240. I apologize for the delay, but there was technical difficulties ensued, so it is now after 10 o'clock. And this is set for a public hearing and possible work session. Senator Burdick, please. And, Claudia Black, Annette Jolin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to come to your subcommittee and talk about Senate Bill 240, which passed the Senate unanimously after coming unanimously through Senate Judiciary. Senate Bill 240 creates in the statute the criminal justice research, excuse me, for the record, I am Jenny Burdick and I'm the state senator from District 18. I can't believe I did that. Senate Bill 240 creates in statute the Criminal Justice Research and Policy Institute in the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. Portland State University is located in my district, and the Hatfield School and the Criminal Justice Research and Policy Institute are real gems. They provide a tremendous service for the criminal justice system as a resource and a fount of peer-reviewed data on what kind of criminal justice policies are effective. And give good support to the criminal justice system. Some of their current projects include an examination of the overlap between the child welfare and correction systems. They staff the state's racial profiling committee, and they are currently evaluating community corrections alcohol and drug abuse prevention program for its effectiveness. This bill would, by putting the institute in statute, it would give it the kind of national stature it deserves to compete for Justice Department grants, and it would put it on its well-deserved footing with other institutions as they go after this grant money to do the kind of research that they do so well here. There have been amendments drafted, the 8-A3 amendments, which I think are very constructive. Most notably, the 8-A3 amendments provide in the statute for a scientific review advisory committee, which really kind of brings out the fact that these research findings are all peer-reviewed It's obviously nonpartisan. It's objective research that is tremendously valuable, especially as we move toward evidence-based practices in our criminal justice system. We don't have enough money to be doing things that don't work, and the Criminal Justice Research and Policy Institute can be a tremendous resource in helping us identify those evidence-based programs. I'd be happy to answer.
That's your closest definition of science, is it?
No, it's not, Mr. Chair, to my knowledge.
Okay, Professor Jolin, I might just add for the committee, I knew Professor Jolin when her ID card said patrolman. So before he went to police officer.
And Mr. Chair, I do need to get back to the.
Thank you very much for your the amount of time you've had to spend over here this morning.
My pleasure. It was actually fun being here.
Okay, yes. Usually we're more organized than we were today, but how that goes.
Mr. Chair, if I
that's fine. Either way, yes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm the interim director of the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute in the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. And I'm here today in support of SB 240A and the -A3 amendments. I wanted you to know that we worked very closely with Chair Krieger in developing the amendments. He'd asked for input from John Menace, the Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and has had the leadership review these amendments. To give you a little bit of background on the history of this bill, a similar bill, SB 16, came to us last session and was introduced by the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee as a result of discussions between then-Senator John Menace and Representative Max Williams. And SB 16 passed the Senate last session but was in Ways and Means upon adjournment. And that bill was introduced and drafted with the thought that research could be helpful to the criminal justice community and policymakers as Oregon addresses issues affecting children, families, and communities impacted by crime. This particular bill outlines the key responsibilities of the Institute, and those include assisting the legislature and state and local governments in developing policies to reduce crime and delinquency by providing cost-benefit analysis, evaluating programs, initiating, conducting, and publishing research, organizing conferences that bring policymakers together with leading criminal justice academicians, and also to strengthen the link between the Criminal Justice Commission, the legislature, state and local governments, and the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Because there's no funding mechanism included in this bill, the ability of the Institute to carry out these responsibilities is predicated upon available resources. Portland State actually established the Institute in 1994 to provide factual information on criminal justice policies and programs to both policymakers and practitioners. And although the Institute is already established, the passage of SB 240 will be helpful to us in that it codifies the relationship with the legislature and state and local governments and also strengthens the Institute's stature nationally. This will help the Institute be competitive when we're applying for both federal and foundation grants, and will put us on a level playing field with criminal justice institutes in other states, such as the Washington Public Policy Institute. The portion of the -A3 amendments that address the inclusion of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training in the bill and focus on law enforcement professionalism were those offered by John Menace, the director of DPSST. We worked with him on these amendments, and we believe that they strengthen the bill and the relationship between the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. This new language also expands the focus of the legislation to include a key aspect of Portland State University's mission, which is specifically to the education and preparation of public service professionals, and that's primarily through the Hatfield School of Government. The -A3 amendments also create the Scientific Advisory Committee, which will be appointed by the director of the Hatfield School of Government. This ensures that research will meet peer review standards. And since there's been some discussion outside this room about the peer review process and the work done by the Institute, I'd like to reiterate that any research done by faculty members or through the Institute must meet exacting peer review standards, and this involves a scrutiny through a blind review process in which other unaffiliated researchers review both the methods and assumptions of any published results, and that's in order to preclude any intentional or unintentional bias in the research activity. And I would like to introduce my colleague, Annette Jolin. She's chair of the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice, and she will say a few words about the peer review process and answer any questions that may arise. She's kind of an expert on that. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present this testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have as well.
Does anybody have any questions before we go on? Ms. Joel?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I'm Annette Jolin. I'm the chair of the Criminology and Criminal Justice Division at Portland State University. I've been at Portland State as a faculty member since 1990, and as Chair Barker indicated, he and I were in the Police Academy class together way back in 1974. My purpose is here, as Claudia Black indicated, to perhaps talk a little bit more about what this peer review process that we were talking about entails. And what it really is, it's the peer review is sort of the end point of an entire system that is set up as checks and balances for making sure that information that we are observing, measuring, actually is bias-free or error-free. So there is a method, what's called the scientific method, and that actually is simply an approach. It's not a simple approach, but it is an approach, a method that entails procedures, the same ones, by the way, that are used in medical research or in any other field. In this case, they're just focused on substantive criminal justice issues. And it's characterized by transparency in the sense that we have to write down everything we do, say exactly how we define a term, how things are measured, and at each point the purpose of that is to reduce error or to take out possible biases coming into that would then affect the findings. So by the time we're done having applied this scientific method to a criminal justice issue, we have the best possible knowledge we can have, meaning it has not been influenced by external factors that have nothing to do with the examination of this particular question. And that actually, those are checks on us as well as anybody else, because there are researcher biases, just that some of them we're not aware of, that can creep in. And there all these methods are established all the way through to guard against that. And in the end, the peer review process comes once we have determined what our findings are. That then is turned over to peers. Those are experts in our substantive field who have themselves been taught and trained in this scientific method to look again at what we did every step by step and examine whether it was done in accordance with those principles of the scientific method and whether or not those findings that we arrived at can be trusted. So at the end of this whole process, you get a kind of a stamp of, you know, good housekeeping stamp of approval on your information. What it means is that the information you get if you apply this process is reliable and is valid. And it is the kind of information that I think you want to have when you make major decisions on either allocating or reallocating funds, changing organizations, or changing procedures, or developing new procedures. Before you do that, you should, and this is what's called evidence-based decision-making today, or knowledge-based decision-making, but it refers to information, the base on which you make decisions should be information that has gone through this rigorous process. And that is what we can offer. And our faculty are highly trained. We have really an excellent staff. They have been trained in research methods, and they bring this to bear on the subjects that come before this committee. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for
Mr. Chair, the question for both people on the panel, how does the work of the Institute relate to the Criminal Justice Commission?
I'd probably like to ask the director of the Criminal Justice Commission to come up and address that, since we've been having ongoing conversations.
Okay, great.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, thank you for the question. And for the record, my name is Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. That's a great question, and one we've been talking about. And as you know, Representative Olson is on the commission as well, and Senator Burdick is also on the Criminal Justice Commission, and it's her bill. I see the way we work together would be somewhat how we've worked together on the racial profiling bill, which is Senate Bill 415 that was passed in 2001. Ms. Black, I have contracted with Ms. Black to work with PSU to do review how we're collecting the data on that, and then also to work with the community outreach on that. And it's been a good partnership. The key to me, Representative McPherson, is that in the A3 amendment, the change of the advisory committee scientific advisory committee to the peer review that was spoken about. I think what the commission needs to do is have a partner that can do more of the research and more of the analysis. But I want to make sure that the commission keeps the policy issues and makes the decisions based upon those, and can direct where that analysis goes. And so I hope that we can do it the way we've done some of the work in the past. And I think that we have a good partnership, that we've worked on other things. And the A3, I think, makes that change to make it clear that that's a scientific advisory group that is making sure that the data can stand up, so that the policymakers on the commission can use it and can be comfortable with it. And as staff for the commission, that makes me more comfortable that, one, the commission is not being supplanted, and two, that they can rely on that data. So I hope that it's that type of relationship, and it's a type of relationship that other states have used with their sentencing commissions. The relationship in Washington, for example, with the Washington's State Institute of Public Policy, they actually have three separate, you know, they do most of the analytical work. Then they also have a sentencing commission, and then they also have what we used to have, like a council, a criminal justice council. They've broken it up. And there's also, I think it's Texas has the same. I'll have to check which one. We were just looking with the commission on different ways we can do our business. One way would be to have everything done within the commission. Our commission in Oregon has a lot of non-policy responsibilities, and I think this mode would work well for us. We'd be partnering with higher ed. So I hope that answers.
That's very helpful background. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Dole?
Morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm with Crime Victims United of Oregon, and I'm here in my sometimes role as skunk at the picnic, or maybe off-time roles, depending on your purview. I want to say this. We don't object to this on its face. I mean, we're certainly not against research. We're certainly not against universities. We're certainly not against finding what works, because that's what we want, especially in programs. Crime Victims United wants to find drug and alcohol programs at work. If there was such a thing out there, which I know we continue to search for, if there was such a thing as sex offender treatment that worked, we want to find that. But here's our main concerns with this. And I had some questions answered for me, and I kind of understand this a little bit better, but one of the main concerns we have is that we would like to see this, as Mr. Prince stated, as a function that the commission uses to contract with. In other words, this is not new to us. This bill has actually been up three times now. This is the third legislative session this thing's been up. It was up in 2001, 2003, and now this year, and I know that for a fact. What we're concerned with is them being able to reach into the general fund budget and be one more entity that's going after general fund dollars. One of the things that we would be satisfied with is as long as the contracting is being done through the Criminal Justice Commission, and they have control over it, and they deliver the funds to them for a study, that would satisfy some of our concerns, and if that makes sense to you. We also are concerned, however, with studies in and of themselves. I mean, it's one thing to study programs, but when you start reaching in to sentencing policy, that gets to another issue. And I think that as a friend of mine who is on the Multnomah County Court, Judge Michael Marcus, who is, believe me, nobody's raging conservative, we've developed a good friendship. But Michael Marcus himself will tell you that it's hard to find an academic who's ever going to be pro-incarceration or show you a study in which they say that incarceration is a good thing. They have a natural inherent bias against it. I've been at enough meetings over the last 10 years since I've been involved in this where I've actually heard an academic at one time from University of California, Berkeley State. We try to find ways in which we can drive the costs of incarceration up to make it abhorrent to the public. Now, we got that on tape. I've seen some of the studies. I mean, some of them are, and that's what we have a concern with, such as a study where I was invited to Portland State, and they'll probably never invite me back after stating this out loud because I know it's still in its infancy, but they're talking about when you take 3.2 people out of 1,000 population in the neighborhood, that this is harmful to the neighborhood, socially, culturally, and economically. And they were looking at inner northeast Portland neighborhoods. That's where I grew up. I know those neighborhoods real well. And I still know those neighborhoods. And I'd tell you this, that I think if you took a child molester, a drug dealer, and an armed robber out of the neighborhoods, I'm sure that most of the good citizens would tell you they would be real happy about that. And they had this figure of 3.2 as a tipping point. They have this other study that talks about if you give people more good time, it's going to cut recidivism. And, you know, if you take that out to its natural end, then why would you ultimately send anybody to prison? Because if a 20% good and 40% is better, than 60% has got to be great and 80% has got to be the best that we can do. I mean, there's no end to it. So we have some questions around these so-called studies, and while it's hard to disparage what these women said here this morning, the professor and Ms. Black, it all sounds good here, but when the studies start to roll in, what we'd like to make sure that happens is that when the legislature is looking at studies, if this study, and I don't mean this necessarily in the political context, but if this study is on the right and this study is on the left, we don't just give you the left study or the right study. We give you both sides of the coin so that you can look at them and then the legislature can make a determination. Is it good policy to send a child molester off to prison for 25 years, or is it good policy to give him probation? And while you may laugh at that on the face, remember that before Measure 11, we were giving 34% of the sex offenders in first and second degree sex offenses probation. Remember that when they talk about alternatives to incarceration, which there's a lot of talk about, we need more alternatives, that according to Mr. Prinz's organization, the Criminal Justice Commission, 72% of the felons in this state don't go to prison. Well, that would indicate to me that we have a lot of alternatives to incarceration in this state. So we're just, you know, it's hard for me to oppose this thing, but I just want to lay down on the record what some of our concerns are and hopefully be able to work with these people and with Senator Burdick on these concerns. And one other thing I'd just like to bring up, and I'll end this. There's something called the Maryland Method of Scientific Study, and they've got an attached study that's called Preventing Crime, What Works, What Doesn't, and What's Promising. But I want to, the Maryland Method of Scientific Study, when it comes to presenting studies to the legislature, I would ask the legislature to look at this Maryland study, because it's very rigorous. And I think that when we look at studies such as a tipping point of taking 3.2 people out of 1,000 population, or adding, saying that, you know, more good time cuts, recidivism, et cetera, that we want to apply very rigorous studies, that we should not make associations, not mere associations. There has got to be cause and effect. It's not like we can say, well, when the birds fly north in the spring, the tulips come up. Well, the birds don't cause the tulips to come up. We all know that. So anyway, those are some of our concerns. I very much appreciate your time and listening to this, and I'd ask you to put those under consideration as we move forward with this. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And I think we will do that. The people that are here hopefully will be back next time. They'll be able to take a look at some of those studies and watch for things. And I think from what I heard from Professor Jolin, they're going to use a strict methodology, and hopefully that will alleviate some of your concerns. So you need to move which amendments, Mr. Taylor?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mayor, yes. Yes.
Okay, so we'll move to a work session on Senate Bill 240.
Mr. Chair, I'd move, make motion move the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 240.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I'd move then Senate Bill 240 as amended to the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Okay, any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Bolton?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Any further business before the committee today? Adjourned.